Mormon Stories is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and relies solely upon the support of people like you, its listeners. To help keep the podcast alive or to become a member of the community, please become a monthly subscriber by visiting mormonstories.org and clicking on the donate button on the right side of the page under support. All contributions to Mormon Stories are completely tax deductible and go towards producing the podcast and building communities and programs of support for Mormons like you. Thanks for your support.
Circling gloom, lead thou me on. The night is dark and I am far from home. Lead thou.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Mormon Stories Podcast. I'm your host, John DeLynn, and I am here on September 17, 2014. In my fifth segment of an interview with one of the, in my view, one of the most important scholars in the 20th/21st century Mormonism. His name is Brent Metcalf. We've talked about his early years in the church, his you know, collaborations with Steve Christensen and Mark Hoffman, the famous bomber. That ended up killing two people and harming himself before he ended up in jail. We've talked about his subsequent sort of aftermath of the Mark Hoffman bombings. We've talked about a book that he put together called New Approaches to the Book of Mormon and his subsequent disciplinary council that came about as a result of that book. And then we did a deep dive into the Book of Mormon and Brent's sort of views on some of the challenges that modern Mormons face when taking a traditional approach to the Book of Mormon, meaning viewing it as a literal translation of an ancient record or as a history. And so now we have just a few more segments to go with Brent. We're going to talk about sort of what came later in his life after his excommunication, now that we talked about the Book of Mormon. And this is going to lead to a discussion about another in-depth, some more in-depth research that he's done on the Book of Abraham, which has received a lot of attention lately as the LDS Church published an essay, sort of, in my view, retreating a bit in terms of how it deals with the Book of Abraham. We're going to talk about sort of modern LDS apologetics and Brent's view on apologetics. You know, good, bad, and ugly, and awesome. We're going to talk a little bit about his views on the church today and maybe its future. And then we're going to end talking about a couple things. One is sort of Brent's life as a post-Mormon, what has brought him joy and happiness and meaning and other such things. And finally, we're going to have a big, big announcement at the end. Well, I won't say it's a big, big announcement, but I think it has the potential to be a big, big project that Brent is looking to begin embarking upon. We don't want to build it up too big until we're able to start seeing it through. But with all that ado, Brent Metcalf, welcome back to Mormon Stories.
Thank you, John. I appreciate that.
And I hope you're feeling better.
I am, actually. And yeah, it was a lingering, you know, flu or whatever it was that I had. And I'm feeling much, much better now.
Good. Well, good. Well, let's go ahead and just dive right in. So we ended last segment talking about the Book of Mormon, and we talked about the Book of Mormon because that was the subject matter of the book that led to your excommunication. And so before we dig into the Book of Abraham, why don't you talk to us just a bit more about your life and what happened after the excommunication, any interesting stories that you want to tell that kind of lead up to your decision to study the Book of Abraham in depth?
Yeah, so subsequent to my excommunication, I think I had mentioned in one of the previous episodes that my mother had been interested in testifying on my behalf. And it was interesting because my mom and I had you know, a somewhat strained relationship over issues relating to the LDS Church, which I think is natural for a lot of parents who feel very fervent about an ideology, whether it's a religion or even a political party that they belong to. To have a child who is no longer a part of what they've given a significant portion of their life to is not an easy thing. But it was interesting because in the year following my excommunication, my mom was diagnosed with colon cancer. And only given a matter of months to live, and that was a remarkably healing time for us. And you know, my son was, and the youngest of my children was actually born just 3 weeks after she passed away, and I remember going in and. You know, spending time with her frequently during that time. And this was one thing that was interesting because she would say to me as I'd be leaving, be strong as a phrase, or she would use the Maori term kia kaha, and which is, the phrase to be strong. And my son now, who, as I said, was born just a few weeks after that, has a fairly large tattoo on his left side, going down the left side of his torso, that is a kind of a pan-Polynesian design that is the words Kia Kaha written on it. And, you know, that's his way of remembering his grandmother that he never had the fortune to meet, and that still knows all the stories that I've told about her. And it's interesting because at her funeral, my mom actually had planned out what the funeral would entail and who all the speakers would be, and she insisted that all of her children be allowed to speak. And the topic that I spoke on was the stories that we tell about each other and how we tell them, not always with words, but sometimes with just the way we present ourselves to others, and that we are constantly, as a species, telling stories about both ourselves and others that we know. And there were a number of general authorities who were in attendance at her funeral. And I remember that Neil A. Maxwell was evidently fairly touched by what I had to say, because the last thing I remember as I was getting ready to leave the stand, as I turned over and looked at him and just... not even intentionally, I just glanced over in his direction, and I remember seeing him wiping a tear away from his eyes as I, you know, went back to sit down in the audience. And there was a mention of the fact in my talk, I mentioned that I was no longer LDS, but that our love had transcended that, and that we cared deeply about each other and loved each other. And Gordon Hinckley was also in attendance, and he was called upon to speak. And it's kind of one of those, I guess, times where you have that because, you know, he came up in the context of my excommunication and so on, and his conversation with my dad is a conversation with my state president so many years before that, when I was forced to resign from my job. And then, you know, here we are, my mom's funeral, and he's there as well. And he spoke. They asked him if he would share some words, and the funeral was very well attended. And it was just interesting because, to a certain degree, I almost felt like this was my mom's way of saying, you know, I'm going to have the last laugh when it comes to my son, because I'm going to have him on the same podium, same stand with the rest of you, speaking as one of the principal players at my funeral. And it was just kind of an interesting twist, because this was, you know, well within the time period of where discussions had gone on about whether or not someone who's not LDS could speak at all at an LDS member's funeral. And I ended up, along with my siblings, being one of the principal speakers. And it was a very, very difficult talk to give, very emotional, very raw, and from the heart. And I had only written it down. It wasn't a very long talk. You know, it was on a single piece of paper, and I had written it down just the night before. And very moving event, in any event.
Do you have any reason to believe your mom reached a level of sympathy for your positions before she passed away, or do you think she died sort of either not understanding or not having sympathy for your position?
No. I would say that none of the above, almost. It was that the realization that our love for each other went beyond any position on anything, and that, you know, we deeply loved each other, and that I think was what really came through. And she even I know brought it up to at least my brother, if I remember correctly, her feelings about the whole situation, and just said, you know, blood is thicker than ideology, and that she cared for me deeply, and you know, I had every bit as much access to her as anyone during that time, and I was there when, you know, all the blessings were given and everything else, and I wouldn't have wanted it any other way, and I don't think that she would have. And so no, I don't think it was a matter of being sympathetic with an idea or even understanding a person's position on something. It was a realization that love transcends that, and that you can love someone who believes fundamentally different than you on certain things, and that that doesn't matter, and that there's not this driving necessity that there always has to be a meeting of the minds, that sometimes love is what matters, and the rest will kind of fall into place.
Nice.
So, yeah. Yes.
Okay. So, so what came next? Was that in 2000? Was that in 1995 then, or 1994?
Correct. Okay. It was 95. It was September 1995.
Okay.
And then my son was born in October, and My mom, if I remember correctly, actually passed away on my youngest sister's birthday. And I remember that being such a bittersweet moment, you know, that because all the family was together, we were all there. And in fact, two of my mom's sisters were there from New Zealand, at least two. One of my uncles from New Zealand, who then was living in the United States. And yeah, we were all there when she passed away. We were all there in the bedroom with her. And I just remember this, you know, such an outpouring of emotion, because you had in the room, you know, such an interesting mix of people. Although I was the only ex-Mormon, my uncle hadn't been active in the LDS Church since he was a young boy. And but none of that mattered, you know. It didn't matter.
That's great.
We were family.
That's great.
That's all that mattered. And yeah. And then subsequent to that, you know, as time has gone on, I've had the wonderful fortune of being married to a wonderful woman. Her name is Erin. And Erin is actually an award-winning independent historian, and we've had the great opportunity to do our own research projects, both independently and jointly. And we actually gave a presentation at the last John Whitmer Historical Association meeting, where and I should mention that she's the president-elect right now of that association. So next year she'll be the president of the association. But we did a study jointly analyzing what's been commonly known as the Anton transcript, which, oh, and by the way, it is pronounced with a hard T, the Anton, not Thun. But the Anton transcript that has been thought to be the document that Martin Harris took to Charles Anton. And as it turns out, that is almost certainly not the case, what that document is. But there was a photograph of the document that was taken in the later 1800s that showed that the document was actually originally part of a longer piece, a half sheet, essentially a foolscap paper, and it had additional handwriting on it. And so through very laborious, extensive analysis on our part, we came to a conclusion that actually happens to disagree with what the folks at the Joseph Smith Papers Project came up with. They suggested that the document had been written by John Whitmer, whereas we are actually very confident that the document was written by in the handwriting of John's older brother, Christian Whitmer. And it would be, again, along with a few other manuscript revelations that have been unknown as to who the handwriting was for years, that he is, in fact, the scribe of those individual documents. And that also makes him unknown scribe number three on the original Book of Mormon manuscript. And so we would have identified now all of those whose handwriting appears on the original Book of Mormon manuscript as, you know, Oliver Cowdery, primary. Joseph Smith wrote about approximately a verse. And then the other two handwritings is John Whitmer and Christian Whitmer. So that was just a remarkable find, and it was a fun project for us both to work on, and just a wonderful discovery to find out more about this Whitmer brother. And Erin had done just incredible research into the Whitmer family, and so it was wonderfully dovetailed with all the genealogical research and everything else that she had done. But so that's been exciting for both of us to be able to work on projects together.
So you guys geek out on Mormon history together.
Oh, and in fact, this coming week we'll be going to the John Whitmer Historical Association meeting that will be in Lamoni, Missouri, and which is basically the chief headquarters of Graceland University for the Community of Christ. And she's running the program essentially this year, and I'll be giving a presentation. This time it'll be a little bit different topic. I'm actually, one of the things that came out in the Joseph Smith Papers Project was that they had discovered in one of the first Revelations books that there is a revelation in there that has been, really we haven't had a copy of it before. It's a sample of the pure language, or the Adamic language, if you will, where it goes through and explains, you know, what the name of God, the Son of God, the children of men, and so on, are in the Adamic language, and then gives a bit of an interpretation on them. And up until now, that has been thought to have been the only example that we have of that revelation. And in the course of some of the research that I have been doing on the presentation that Aaron and I gave, I came across another copy. And the other copy is also very early, in the 1830s, and may very well represent an even earlier version of the revelation itself than what appears in Revelation Book 1, which is also called the BCR, the Book of Commandments and Revelations, that you can see on the Joseph Smith Papers website. So this is going to be an additional source to then what we've had before that discusses Joseph Smith's views on the Adamic language, which, interestingly enough, is a perfect segue into talking about the Book of Abraham. Because one of the things that I discovered in the course of this research was that the Adamic language, Joseph Smith's explorations and experimentations with it, leading into his translation of the Egyptian papyri, are actually very connected. And as an example, in May 26th, of 1835, William W. Phelps wrote to his wife, Sally, and gave a specimen, what he calls a specimen of the pure language. And in there, it's very interesting because he has this little graph drawn out where he has these interesting looking characters going down the left side, and then he has what is the equivalent of sounds of these characters in another column. And then he has what effectively looks like the translation of these characters in a column after that. And I mentioned that he wrote on May 26, 1835, but he actually breaks open the letter and adds more to it on May 27th and adds an addendum to it. But what's interesting is that in July, he's now purchased the papyri from Michael Chandler, and one of the early portions of the project that he begins working on is what's called an Egyptian alphabet. And there are three manuscripts that are effectively what I call the triplet manuscripts of the Egyptian alphabet, because they're so similar to each other. And portions of them, I suspect, were being dictated simultaneously. And what's important about these three documents is that the bulk, well, in two of them, one is in William W. Phelps's handwriting, one is in Oliver Cowdery's handwriting, and the other one, the vast majority of it, is actually in Joseph Smith's handwriting. And in that document, this is what's intriguing, is on the front, the first page of that document, toward the bottom of the page, there are a group of characters that appear sequentially with various interpretations being given. And this grouping of characters is identical to the grouping of characters, with just a subtle difference, to the characters that William W. Phelps records in this letter from May of 1835. But that's before the papyri have even been purchased. Joseph Smith hasn't even seen them yet. And yet these characters that, you know, ostensibly represent themselves as the Adamic language are now being replicated in this Egyptian alphabet. And what's interesting about it is that one set of the characters has a slightly right-leaning characteristic to them, almost like you could consider one to be an italicized version of the other. And William W. Phelps, when he records the characters in his manuscript, he records both versions right next to each other. And so, effectively, you have in the Egyptian alphabet manuscripts, after Joseph Smith has purchased the papyri, these characters that, you know, ostensibly come from the Adamic language showing up in the exact same sequence as they do in Phelps's letter. And as I said, one of these manuscripts for that portion certainly is in Joseph Smith's handwriting. And so you have this very early effort at not just simply translating Egyptian, but you have these other characters which seem to come from another language, an even more primitive language, a prelapsarian language of Adam when he was speaking with God in the garden. And here you have these characters, and you have in Phelps's letter as well an idea of what they ended up doing in the entire Book of Abraham project when you look at the manuscripts, where you see these different characters showing up in the left margin, and then you see their ostensible translations appearing in the right area of the documents. And so that occurs throughout many of these documents.
So, Brent, back up a bit and just, you know, it's easy to kind of get lost in a lot of these details, but at the same time, it's such a treat to have an expert to be able to tell us what's going on. But let's back up.
And to be honest with you, John, it's so easy for me to go off on tangents. Sure. because I find this stuff fascinating.
Yeah. No,
and
that's good.
You're watching the evolution of these documents coming out.
Sure.
And it's just so intriguing to me to see it unfold.
So what do you guess is going on? Why is Joseph spending his time trying to produce an Adamic language and a translation of the language? You know, all of this before he ever purchases the papyri. What would be his motive, and what's inspiring this, and what does he hope to get out of it?
Right. Well, I think to a certain degree the initial impetus is coming from the work that he's doing on the new translation of the Bible, or at least that's something that brings it to the forefront. Because in there, you have this notion of this language that God is speaking with Adam, and that it's a pure language. And so I think that has really captured his imagination. And I think that if we were to map out, and again, because like you said, it's really easy to get lost in all of this, but I suspect that in his thinking, what he was envisioning is that you have a pure language, which again is the prelapsarian language that Adam and God are using before the fall, and then he teaches it to his children. And then you have kind of these branches and trajectories that happen subsequently to create different languages. So, for example, Hebrew, I suspect, is the language that Joseph Smith probably thought was the closest to the original pure language. Other languages that may be, you know, subordinate to that would be perhaps Reformed Egyptian, which the Book of Mormon is, because it gets modified, right? Over time, it's been modified. And so that's been changed. Egyptian would fall somewhere in there as well. And hence the reason why these Adamic characters are showing up in the Egyptian alphabet manuscripts, but now they have different meanings. Well, of course, because that language is corrupt, right? It's not the pure language. And so that is what I suspect is going on during that early time period. So in 1832, I believe it's around March of 1832, is likely when Joseph Smith, you know, gave this revelation on what, you know, these different terms mean in the pure language. You know, Amun is the name of God, Son Amun, the name of the Son of God or Jesus Christ, Sons Amun, the name of the children of men, and so on. That, I suspect, is when he's actually starting to trying to figure out the language. So now when Michael Chandler
okay,
shows up.
Quick question. Yeah. So, but does, I mean, is he just trying to, I mean, so the view that Joseph Smith wasn't what he claimed to be would be that he's just making up silliness to fool people, right?
Right.
Or he like really thought he was channeling God's original language, and this is an act of sincerity where he's like, oh no, God has told me that he's got an original language and I'm going to start channeling it. I mean,
right.
How do we explain what benefit he gets from doing anything with what he claimed to be Adamic language?
Well, I think in this case, you know, for all I know, and again, I can't say this is exactly what he was thinking at really any given point in time.
Of course.
But I would say that this may have been a whole nother project that he was, you know, contemplating at some point to do something that would be centered on the Adamic language. And we know of instances, for example, where prior to the School of the Prophets, which really doesn't kick into gear with the Hebrew until January of 1836, that he's clearly toying with the Hebrew language in the months preceding that in a more academic way, in the sense that he's reading about Hebrew language and meaning and so on. But prior to that, there's some good evidence that he was toying with Hebrew language that really isn't Hebrew at all, and sounds much closer to the types of things that we find in this pure language or in this the Egyptian terminology that he comes up with when he gets to the papyri. So I suspect that he saw the pure language perhaps as being part of the gathering process, right, of gathering all of the saints back to Zion. Because one of the first inklings that we have of a word that's actually in the Adamic language is from 1831. So on November 17th, 1831, the Ohio Star publishes a letter that had been written from Ezra Booth to his minister friend, Ira Eddy, where on the 14th of November of 1831, where he says that there was a sapling that was located on the Temple Square block in Independence, Missouri. And then on one side of the sapling, there was a T that had been carved into it that stood for temple. And on the other side, there were the letters Z-O-M. Zome, right? Which he said, Joseph said, stood for the word Zomar, which he said was the word for Zion in the original language. So already, even at that early point, Joseph Smith is already talking about this, you know, again, this prelapsarian language of Adam And I suspect that this is starting to build up. And keep in mind, this is at the same time where he's talking about Adam on Diamond, right? Over by Far West. And that this is the place where, after Adam was expelled from the Garden of Eden, this is the place where Adam resided. And so this is all actually fitting really neatly into this little package of the gathering, that they're all going to come back to essentially what was the area that the Garden of Eden was in. And that's what's happening. And I think that that's what's giving him attention to the pure language and to the Adamic language, is that, you know, their plan is that's where they're all going to come. Too. All the saints are going to gather there. And they will be in the region, in the valley where Adam dwelt, right? It's actually a beautiful area. I've been to Adam on Diamond, and a very beautiful area. And that's what I suspect was driving it, was that the pure language would eventually be the language they would all speak once they had gathered, and once Adam had returned to unite his children. Okay.
So you don't have a theory as to whether or not he really believed he was channeling God's pure language. You don't have a theory on that.
Let me put it this way. For a scholarly enterprise of investigating this type of thing, I don't think a theory is needed. But I would say this, and this is where, you know, my dear friend of many, many years, Dan Vogel, and I don't necessarily see eye to eye, is that, for example, with the Egyptian materials, Dan is fairly convinced that all of these documents that Joseph Smith produced, you know, the bound grammar and alphabet of the Egyptian language, the Egyptian alphabet manuscripts, as well as the Book of Abraham manuscripts themselves, belie this idea that in actual fact he was deceiving people, and in Dan's model it would be more of a pious fraud type of model. Whereas I look at the number of documents he produced, and that's where I have the most difficult time in assuming that he was being intentionally fraudulent, because why produce these documents at all? Nobody was going to see them, right? I mean, there was no reason to show these to anyone or to try and use them in any meaningful way. And if you say, well, the reason why he did it was so that he could, you know, garner the support of his scribes, Warren Parrish, Oliver Cowdery, William W. Phelps, Frederick T. Williams, he wanted to reinforce with them his ability to translate these different things. I would say, but why at all? They already all believed that. There was no reason to make this an object lesson. And so it seems to me, as I look at these documents, that there really is some type of concerted effort to make sense of all of this. Now, did Joseph Smith know Egyptian when he was working on the Egyptian papyri and know how to translate it? No. I see absolutely zero evidence for that. And all kinds of evidence to say, no, he didn't. But at the same time, in looking at these various documents, I see an actual effort underway that seems to be over and above trying to pull one over on someone. I don't really see that going on in these documents. And if I did, I would be, you know, happy to acknowledge that. I just don't see that. And instead, and again, this is outside of all the scholarly analysis of going through and analyzing in the most minute details all of these texts. I don't see this, you know, intentional fraud being perpetrated on his colleagues. I have a hard time with that.
Okay.
And again, you know, here's an example of Dan, who I think is a very gifted interpreter of Mormon things, and me, who spent, you know, years looking at these things, coming to two very different conclusions. But I suspect that if Dan and I were to sit down and analyze the texts themselves, we would come to extremely similar conclusions.
Right. Okay. All right. So we know that Joseph is thinking about, you know, the Garden of Eden and Adam and all that stuff, you know, in the early 1830s. We know that he's trying to do a retranslation of the Bible and that he's got an interest in Adamic language and other languages. Just tell us briefly, just give us a little bit of background on Chandler and the papyri before we dive into the translation.
Well, Chandler had been traveling around certain segments of the country exhibiting this papyri. And he came, he had heard, I think, of Joseph Smith, came to the Kirtland area and exhibited the papyri there in, you know, late June or early July 1835. And Joseph Smith effectively, almost immediately, lifted these documents and said, these are the writings of, you know, Father Abraham and Joseph of Egypt.
Now, where would he connect, you know, Egyptian mummies and scrolls with Joseph?
Well, that's actually, again, going off of the fact that he had been working on his new translation of the Bible for years prior to that. I think that that's actually a very small leap to make, because in the Bible, in the Hebrew scriptures that we have now, we have the narrative in the book of Genesis of Abraham going into Egypt and, you know, his encounter with Pharaoh. We have Joseph, who is sold into Egypt by his brothers. This is not a huge leap. And so the idea, if he were to see any significance in terms of his Judeo-Christian heritage within these Egyptian papyri, Abraham and Joseph of Egypt are the first two patriarchs that would come to mind, right? Those are the two natural ones that you would assume he would make a connection with. And so the idea that that he looked at these Egyptian documents and said, oh, these are related to Patriarch Abraham and Patriarch Joseph, that actually is, it makes a great deal of sense given the biblical narratives that we have.
Okay. So in other words, Joseph, you know, has Egypt on his brain because he's translating the Old Testament. I say translating in quotes. And so because he has Egypt on the brain, somebody rolls in with an Egyptian, you know, Egyptian scrolls and a mummy, and he's like, oh, it's got to be related to Joseph of the Old Testament.
Right, and Abraham. And those are very natural figures. There are people who back in the early 19th century who said that he also related it to Moses. That's much less clear to me that that's the case. But again, think of those characters. All of them are related to Egypt. And so those are natural characters that you would gravitate to in Judeo-Christian tradition as being, you know, prophets who were closely associated with Egypt.
Okay, and I'm probably being thick here, but I'll just have you and my listeners bear with me. Tell me again, I know what Joseph has to do with Egypt. What does Abraham have to do with Egypt?
Well, you recall that after he leaves Chaldea and goes to Haran, he then journeys into Egypt. And you recall the story of the concern over how the Egyptian king would find his wife fair and beautiful, and then the story of how he lies to the king in saying that this is my sister, and so on, rather than his wife. That's Abraham's sojourn in Egypt. And so, you know, and to say nothing of the fact that there were numerous stories and traditions, legends, and so on from the Jewish Midrash that were also circulating in the early 19th century about Abraham and his time in Egypt. And so, yeah, the connection is actually very close with Abraham. And Abraham would have been a key figure for Joseph anyway. There were other things going on as well that come out a bit in the Book of Abraham, because the ecclesiology of early Mormonism was evolving during that time period, and you had the notion of patriarchal priesthood coming to the forefront. And in fact, it's interesting how these kind of fit into each other, because Oliver Cowdery and Joseph are both working on the Patriarchal Blessing Book. And, excuse me, that's my sickness coming through, I guess. And that would have been September of 1835.
Okay.
And that figures into the Book of Abraham tale. If you look at the narrative, you have this notion that Abraham is seeking after the right of the priesthood, and that that's one of his, that's what he wants to become, a righteous minister, and so he's seeking after the right that is his to the priesthood. Well, that's the patriarchal authority, or the patriarchal priesthood. And so that was a development, and my apologies to all of our listeners for my raspy voice, but that was the development in early Mormon priesthood and ecclesiology, where you had this notion of patriarch and patriarchal priesthood, where the fathers would pass down this order to the sons. And that's what's also in the Book of Abraham. And so, again, what you see with this, this is where I think a lot of people miss on what on earth, you know, going back to your question, why Abraham? Why would he figure in this? And I would say, because this is a remarkable confluence of ideas that are all coming together here. You have this notion of Adamic language he's been working on. You have this development in priesthood authority with this notion of patriarchal priesthood. And then you have these Egyptian fragments, you know, papyri showing up. And all of these things are coming together in almost a perfect storm. And the result is the Book of Abraham. That's what's going to come from this.
And so in his mind, I mean, for this story to be in any way legitimate, Abraham would have had to first exist. Second, he would have had to have traveled to Egypt. Third, he would have had to had some sort of revelation while he was in Egypt. And then four, he would have had to written it down on a scroll. And then five, that scroll would have had to have been buried with some mummy somewhere.
Correct.
And
all of which would be questioned by even some of the more conservative biblical scholars as to whether or not Abraham even existed.
Right.
I mean, once you get past that and say, well, there may have been a person who Abraham is modeled after as a historical figure, you still don't have this notion that that person would have done the things that you read in the patriarchal narratives.
Right.
I think that many biblical scholars would reject that idea of the historicity, if not of Abraham, at least of the patriarchal narratives as they are currently represented.
Okay. And so do we happen to know the date that the mummy that the scrolls were buried with, that mummy died?
Yeah, it's around the second century BC, I believe.
And do we know who the mummy was?
Yeah. it's we assume his name was Horus, and he's identified right on the scroll itself. And I would refer readers rather than me trying to reconstruct all the details of that. Mark Conan has done a remarkable presentation on this that's in Robert Rittner's book from Signature Books, where Robert Rittner translates the various papyri fragments. And Mark's essay is important because he traces the genealogy of this priest that the document is buried with. And we actually have a pretty remarkable amount of information on who this person was when they lived and the line of priests that he came from. And so...
Horus was a priest.
Yes. And
an Egyptian priest who died about 200 BC.
Yeah. And essentially, you know, you're off by a couple of thousand years when it comes to Abraham.
Yeah, so Abraham would have been approximately what?
Well, you know, there are varying theories ranging from, 2500 BC or earlier, up till 1900 BC, 1800 BC. But, you know, that's assuming that you're even dealing with scholars who think that this character ever even existed.
So if Joseph's narrative were true, Abraham, that may not have existed, would have written these scrolls. They would have been preserved for 2,000 years and then put in a random Egyptian priest's burial.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Which would be, in and of itself, you know, miraculous. But
right.
but then when right. we actually have Egyptologists read the scrolls are what?
Well, they're funerary texts for the most part.
Which
they're,
means what? Just like
they're documents relating to the deceased, right? So they're
sort of talking about Horus specifically.
Yeah, yeah, and they're going to be talking about things like what this person is going to be doing in the afterlife, their journey into the nether regions, and so on. And we know it because you know his name appears in several portions. In fact, even though we don't have the original facsimile number 3, that portion of the papyrus is missing. In the woodcut that we have, I think that Horus's name is still legible. And so, you know, we know that that's from the same document. In other words, it's facsimile number 1. We have the original of facsimile number 1 and some of the contiguous portions of the fragments that were connected to that. But we don't have the original of facsimile number 3. But we can tell that that's all part of the same role because Horus's name, again, is identifiable. And so, yeah, you're dealing with funerary documents that have no bearing whatsoever on Abraham or his life.
And as I think I read in the church's essay, Abraham's name doesn't even appear anywhere on the scrolls that we still have, right?
No, nowhere. And nor should we expect it to. Despite the fact that some apologists have suggested that the name Abraham appears on other documents, other Egyptian documents, in those cases, it's almost always appearing in a thaumaturgical context where it's an incantation spell and so on, and the name is being invoked, assuming that that's actually the name that's being used, as part of a long list of heroes and characters and, you know, and so on, as part of some type of grandiose spell. But there's no clear instance in these types of documents, like the ones that were associated with the Book of Abraham, of Abraham's name appearing at all, and nor should we think it would, quite frankly, in the context of these documents. These are documents that I suspect the Egyptians considered sacred, and they were, instructions for what the deceased is to do once they've died, or what the gods will do to the deceased once they've died. And so there would be no reason to even think that that they would be associated in any way with Abraham.
Okay, so I have I don't know if this is a spoiler question, but so if this story, just at the outset, without ever learning one character or one figure of Egyptian, like, this story seems like a non-starter and kind of a hilarity from the outset. Like so preposterous and improbable and obviously not credible, that to me it's mind-boggling that it would even deserve a day's worth of extended study. Yet we have decades and decades and decades of people still trying to prove that it's what, Joseph claimed it was.
Right. But look at how they've done it, John. Everybody focuses on the images, right? So when we go to facsimiles 1, 2, and 3, Joseph Smith gives a number of interpretations of what the pictures are, for example. He'll refer to, for example, on facsimile number 2, you have the four sons of Horus, who have essentially human bodies with the heads of various animals. One has a human head. And Joseph Smith says that they represent the four quarters of the earth. Well, think about that for a second. Here you have these four figures standing here, and he says they represent the four corners of the earth. That's not such an improbable notion, because it's something that we read through the Bible. It's a term that the English-speaking world has grown up with. But, people have said, well, we know that in some instances, in some cases, the four sons of Horus were used to represent the four cardinal points. And I think to myself, have you ever read the Book of Revelation? In the Book of Revelation, we have these wondrous figures who appear, who seem to have the bodies of humans and the heads of various animals. And what are they told to do? God sends them out to the four corners of the earth. Right? And so it's kind of like, so essentially, in looking at these figures that seem to look very much like the types of figures that you hear described in the Book of Revelation, where they are clearly associated with the four corners of the earth, that somehow we think, how could Joseph Smith ever have gotten that right? And that is just a remarkable assumption. It's like, do you know your Bible or not know your Bible? Because by this point, Joseph has already done his own revision of the Bible, the entire Bible. And do you think he doesn't know what's in that text? After going through it and not merely reading the text, but revising the text as he goes. And the notion that somehow that is beyond belief, to think that Joseph Smith could have ever conceived these four figures as the four corners of the earth without divine inspiration, that's what I find remarkable.
But that's
what I find improbable.
Right, of course. So yeah, he knew the Bible, and of course he would make that association. But isn't the bigger point that the four figures aren't what Joseph claimed they were, but there's something else very specific?
Well, actually, the bigger point is that this is where we're talking about trying to interpret images, where we can play with multiple meanings all day long, right? Because like I said, in some instances, the sons of Horus can represent the four cardinal points. In this case, almost certainly not. But all the other images, he's getting way off the mark. But more importantly is when he gets to the hieratic characters or the specific hieroglyphic characters, and he tries to interpret those, and he consistently gets those wrong. Not just wrong, but very wrong.
So give us some examples.
Well, for example, from facsimile number 3, where he says that the king is identified by his name as written in the characters above his hand. We also have the situation with Shulam, whose name is supposedly written in the characters above his head. And in fact, that's not what any of the characters say.
What do they say?
This is, they're identifying other Egyptian material, right? It has nothing to do with anything to do with Abraham, anything to do with this scene, and certainly nothing to do with being, a servant of Pharaoh's or Pharaoh's name or anything else like that. That's not what is in any of these characters. And so when you get to some of the characters on facsimile number 2, for example, where he's had to reconstruct, a fair amount of it, where he's pulled in hieratic characters from other papyri fragments, he'll just make sweeping comments like, this is to be had in the house of the Lord or in the temple, right? The world cannot reveal these numbers. Well, no doubt, because there are no numbers here. And things like that. So when you get to him interpreting the actual hieratic characters, the hieroglyphics, those are not corresponding at all to what he is trying to translate these to mean. And even with the figures, they're just so far from the mark. Like I said, I specifically pulled out the example of the four sons of Horus because that's about as close as you're going to get to something being accurate out of any of it.
So what are some of the obvious misses and mistakes? Some of the gods that are, depicted there that he names one thing, but they're really something else. Give us some examples of those.
Well, the god Men sitting on his throne, which is supposed to be God revealing the grand keys of the priesthood from heaven as the Holy Ghost descends in the form of a dove. This is an Egyptian god. I've almost wondered if he's, caught the part where it looks like his arm is raised to a right angle square, and then there's a flail that sits above it, which is essentially an inverted V. And I've wondered if Joseph Smith may have thought that was a square and a compass of Masonic fame. And because at this point, he is now associating those types of rituals with what's going on in the temple and so on. Because now we're into 1842 by the time he's doing the translation on facsimile number 2. And so there are things like that where you're dealing, it's an ithophallic god. It has, it was originally drawn with an erect penis, which has since been removed. And it may have been restored in more recent editions of the Book of Abraham. I'm not sure offhand. But that had been removed for years. And that's just so far from the mark. Facsimile number 1, how do we even begin to try and understand this as a sacrificial scene involving Abraham? The knife in the hand of Anubis is artificially constructed with the papyri fragments that we have. If you actually impose the knife into his hand, we should still be able to see remnants of its handle. And none of that are there. So again, it's just one problem after another. But more importantly than that is that when you go to the Book of Abraham itself, in Abraham chapter 1, verses 12 and 14, it refers you to facsimile number 1 as being an illustration of the text of the Book of Abraham. When you go to the Book of Abraham manuscripts themselves, those characters that you see, at least the ones that are really Egyptian, because there are some invented characters there, which I can explain in a minute. When you go to the characters that are really Egyptian, they are taken sequentially off of the contiguous fragment that's directly attached to facsimile number one. We don't have a single example of authentic Egyptian characters appearing in those documents, any of the Book of Abraham translation manuscripts, that come from anywhere other than the papyri fragments that we have now. So this, you know, the notion that, oh, it was part of a different portion of the this long scroll that is no longer extant, that is just simply a ludicrous explanation, because the fact is that we have numerous English documents which have preserved the various characters, erratic characters, and so on, that they were associating with the text of the Book of Abraham, and that Joseph Smith associated with the text of the Book of Abraham. And all of them come from the papyri fragments that we have, not from some mysterious, no longer extant portion of the scroll.
Okay. So you know, you're not big on the large scroll theory, that the parts that it was translated, the Book of Abraham were translated from, were from other parts of a scroll that didn't survive the, was it a Chicago fire? Was that right?
Right. Well, absolutely not, because even, I mean, that's not to say that we don't have portions of the papyri that are missing. Of course, there are portions that are missing. We no longer have the original of the Hypocephalus, which is facsimile number two. We no longer have the original for facsimile number three. And so, yeah, of course we have things that are missing. But the point is that in every single document that we have that's associated with the translation of the Book of Abraham, we know where those characters are coming from. They're coming from the papyri fragments that we have. We don't need to look anywhere else. Now, if those documents were showing other erratic characters that were coming from another portion of the manuscript, then there may be an argument to talk about. But there isn't at this point. The text of the Book of Abraham in chapter 1 refers directly to facsimile number 1 as being an illustration to what is being described in that chapter. So what are the characters that are associated with that? They're the erratic characters that are directly attached to that image, that vignette on the Egyptian papyri. You can't, there's no escaping that.
Right.
And the easiest way to deal with that is just to simply acknowledge Joseph Smith did not know how to translate Egyptian.
Right. So before we kind of, you know, move away from the Book of Abraham, are there any other sort of glaringly obvious, really big, you know, big issues with the Book of Abraham, with sort of a traditional approach to the Book of Abraham?
I think that as time goes on, because I've been deeply involved, as of other friends and colleagues of mine who I think are very adept at interpreting, who themselves may come from a much more traditional background or point of view than I do, such as Brian Hoglett, for example, who I think is making great inroads on understanding the text. We have our own disagreements on things, but those are things that can be hashed out in the scholarly literature. It's certainly not something that needs to be hashed out on a one-sided podcast, but I would say that understanding the relationship among the manuscripts and the realization that the Egyptian alphabet documents are in fact the precursor to what comes in the Book of Abraham, I think is something that will also have, resounding repercussions for understanding the Book of Abraham in a traditional sense. And I should add too, John, that one of the things that I have been pleased about so far with the church's statement on the historicity of the Book of Abraham is that I did point out online right after it came out, there were two things that jumped out and hit me, and I posted a number of comments on it online. There was the claim that the Book of Abraham gave a certain age for Abraham when he left Haran, and that there were numerous ancient texts that supported that. When in actual fact, there isn't one that supports the actual age given in the Book of Abraham. And the editors changed that. They went back and modified the statement to reflect that the documents don't actually say that. And so there have been a couple of things like that I've raised online that evidently they've become aware of, and they've changed it accordingly. There is much more, in my opinion, that needs to be corrected and adjusted, but maybe that will come at a future point. I just haven't had time to sit down and write a detailed response.
What important concessions does the church make, or what acknowledgments or concessions does the church make in its Book of Abraham essay? Anything that kind of indicates you and your scholarship?
Oh, well, I would say that the most important overriding concept is simply the allowance, not even necessarily the endorsement of this position, but the allowance for scholars who are faithful LDS to look at the Book of Abraham as something other than a translation of Egyptian, and that it could be, in fact, that the Egyptian papyri functioned as a catalyst that led to an inspired revelation that is the Book of Abraham. That at least allows the scholars to talk about this in an intelligent sense without feeling some type of threat of church discipline for having said this, because this is a huge problem in my mind for the church in dealing with their scholars, because I think, well, I know, with scholars that I've talked to from a variety of locations who would be considered to be more traditional mainstream within the church, that they are grappling with this issue in a significant way. And if you want your scholars to be honest and truthful about something, you can't hold them under some type of microscope that always has them wondering, am I going to be disciplined somehow over this because I'm just trying to tell what I found? And if that's where they're at, then the church needs to just pull scholars out of the business of scriptural research altogether, because you're not going to be happy with the end result on almost any of this. And because if essentially traditional assumptions, whether it be about the revelations and the Doctrine and Covenants, whether it be about the Book of Mormon, the Book of Abraham, even what I call the supra-scripture of Mormonism, the temple ceremony itself, if that's the approach you're going to take, you need to get scholars out of the business of looking at your past at all, because you're not going to be happy with the results. Because I suspect that many scholars are going to come to very non-traditional views of these documents and these texts and these rituals. And the church, if they want to move forward, well into the 21st century, they're going to have to pull way back Vatican II for the Catholic Church opened up the door for a lot of Catholic scholars to look more critically at the biblical texts. Something akin to that almost needs to happen within Mormonism if you want to allow your scholars to be able to move forward with a clear conscience in dealing with these documents. And that's not to say that I'm suggesting that every scholar who's dealt with things, these things in a more traditional way are somehow dishonest or trying to deceive people. I'm just saying that there are more than a handful of scholars who are seriously grappling with these issues, who are beginning to understand what the ramifications of these things are. And I think you need to have a door open for them, or you're going to be backing them into a corner where they're either going to just completely go away, or you're going to be stuck with, you know, some really shoddy apologetics as your quote-unquote scholarship.
Okay. And so what I heard you say and what I've read in the church's essay is that they're basically saying, you know, there are probably many who don't feel like there's any evidence to support the notion that the Book of Abraham is actually a translation of the papyri. And so that they're now saying we're going to allow for a perspective, which basically is that Joseph Smith used the papyri as a way to inspire him. And he channeled the text of the Book of Abraham through some other means, but certainly it wasn't a translation, even though, and this seems to be the most improbable and crazy part about this theory, even though Joseph Smith claimed that he was translating, right?
I mean, essentially what you would have to conclude is that as part of the catalyst theory, I think you would have to say that in having this revelation that he receives of what becomes the Book of Abraham, that Joseph Smith believed that the conduit to this revelation was his translation of the Egyptian. So I think that there are scholars who are LDS who would really have no problem with that, quite honestly. They would say, well, yeah, you know, I mean, God is working with fallible humans. And sure, Joseph Smith could very well have thought that he was translating this. But in reality, he was not. And so then the next step would be, so that is this scripture? Yes. If so, what does that mean in our understanding of what scripture is? And does it necessarily receive its authority as scripture by virtue of the accuracy of the description by which the scripture was received? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So that's what I think is kind of the next round of interpretations is going to entail, is trying to understand what qualifies as scripture, because the problem that I think, and this isn't unique to Mormonism, but I think the problem that many faiths have is that frequently the way they define scripture is as it defines itself within its text. Well, if the assumption is that no scripture is perfect by virtue of the fact that it came through human hands and was not, in fact, just written by God, then you've got an issue here, because you never know whether or not the definition for what scripture is ultimately authoritative or credible. And so that I think is going to be the difficult part moving ahead, is what do we do when we acknowledge that Joseph Smith could not translate Egyptian, thought he was translating Egyptian, and the Book of Abraham was the end product. What does that mean?
Yeah. I mean, it's hard. It would be hard to come up with a more clear smoking gun, or at least indictment, of Joseph not being able to translate as he claimed he could, you know, with the evidence we have about the Book of Abraham. If you add to that the fact that now we know that with the Book of Mormon, he didn't even use the plates, as far as we know, in his, quote, translation of the Book of Mormon, but instead he had a peepstone and a hat, and the plates were often not even in the building. You know, that's not a translation. And it's hard to argue with all the changes that took place between, as you discussed, the original, you know, transcription or manuscript that was produced, all the changes between that and then the printer's manuscript. It's hard to argue that there was any credible translation going on there. Again, especially because it was done with a rock in a hat and not with the plates even around. And then you add the Kinderhook plates. It just feels like that's kind of three strikes against Joseph's ability to translate, in spite of the fact that he claimed to be translating in all three cases. True?
I think that there are actually a number of LDS scholars who are recognizing now that this notion of Joseph Smith being able to translate ancient languages is very weak, and there are numerous other examples we could bring up too. I mean, even you know, the Parchment of John, which appears in the Doctrine and Covenants, which is supposed to be a translation of a document that the Apostle John wrote. And when you look at the original version of it, for example, what you would find in the 1833 Book of Commandments and the earliest manuscripts that we have of this revelation, then you compare it to what it looks like in the 1835 Doctrine and Covenants, this text is almost doubled in size. And it's sort of like, well, if this is a translation of a parchment that John wrote, what on earth has just happened? Because some of these additions to the narrative are being inserted mid-sentence. And what kind of translation is that? What kind of translation goes from, you know, this short, terse piece to this expanded document that, by the way, when it gets expanded, it's being expanded in such a way to account for new developments in Mormon theology during that time. And so it may well be that a better way to look at the translational artifacts that Joseph Smith produced would be to see them as vehicles of his theology and vehicles for communicating his theology or communicating what he believed God was telling him at a given point in time, because they are all morphing and changing to match his current theological positions at any given point in time. And so I think that's going to be the interesting challenge for interpreters of Mormonism in the future, is to try and situate Joseph Smith's translational artifacts on a continuum of his evolutionary theology. And I think what they're going to find is that these were vehicles, just like history is for Joseph Smith. Translational artifacts aren't just the only things, but also his history. Look at his telling of the first vision. That is a vehicle for communicating his theology of God at any given point in time. So the earliest version, we have a quasi popular Trinitarian notion of God, only one person's appearing. But as his understanding of God shifts to binitarianism or bitheism, and eventually to tritheism, it expands until finally you have very explicitly two beings appearing, one after the other, and the other addressing, you know, the one as, "This is my son, hear him." You know, very, very clear enunciations of the separation of the persons of deity. That's not what you have in the early edition. And so again, the first vision narrative itself became one of these vehicles for communicating Joseph Smith's theology at any point along the continuum of his evolution of theology. And I think that the translational productions should be placed and situated on that continuum. That's where they belong, not in antiquity.
Right.
Right?
Right.
They're not ancient documents. They are vehicles for communicating theology.
Yeah, yeah. And again, even if we abandon the idea that he was translating and say that he's a prophet, he can channel things from God, that's fine, except for the fact that he claimed to be translating, right?
Right. That's always going to be a certain... There will always be a tension there in trying to interpret any of his translations in any other way. Whether you're talking... I mean, look at how he described his Bible revision. He called it the New Translation of the Bible. He uses the word translation in so many contexts. You know, the Parchment of John that we were mentioning just a few minutes ago, that's now published in DNC 7. Again, that was a translation of the Parchment of John.
Except in that case, he claims that it was a scroll in some cave that he was able to translate sort of mystically, right?
Well, we really don't know. I mean, in fact, the idea of it being a translation of a parchment that John had created is something that actually enters into it in the later manuscripts. And so in the early manuscripts, there's no real mention that I recall anyway, and I think I'm remembering this accurately. I don't think that there's any mention of it being a translation. It's just that when you read it, it's, what else is it? Because it's being spoken of, you know, it as a first-person narrative, as if somebody who is directly familiar with these conversations with John and so on is recording this. And, you know, you don't really have this clear notion of Peter, James, and John, for example, holding the keys of the kingdom. Well, of course not, because the notion of Peter, James, and John as part of the priesthood restoration is a later development. That's not something from 1829. There's no Melchizedek priesthood in 1829 within the church, right? And so this idea that we have, again, these narratives are vehicles for communicating theology. So now we get this grand explanation of a restoration of Melchizedek priesthood, where Peter, James, and John now hold the keys of the kingdom. And they're revealing the Melchizedek priesthood to Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery. We can find nothing that you could begin to reconstruct that developed of a model in 1829. There is nothing. You're not even going to find it in 1830. There is nothing that would lead you to believe that narrative of the restoration of the Melchizedek priesthood, as it receives its final form, could possibly be what happened in 1829. Because you have in DNC 7 the notion that Peter, James, and John now hold the keys of the kingdom. Well, if that was the case, why wasn't that the natural outgrowth of the earliest ecclesiology, where instead of having a first presidency made up of three men who hold the keys of the priesthood and the church, as we have with Peter, James, and John, instead we have a first elder and a second elder. There are only two, Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery. Why? Because the notion of this triad as being the keepers of the keys had not fully evolved yet. That would come later. And that's when we eventually end up with the presidency of the high priesthood, not even the Melchizedek priesthood at this point, that eventually becomes a first presidency. And then we start hearing discussion about Melchizedek priesthood within the church.
So what if somebody just says, well, big deal, Brent, like he was learning by bit. He was getting truth by truth, grace by grace, and he hadn't received the fullness of the gospel. And so, yeah, it's going to evolve over time as his understanding deepens and clarifies.
And I would say, perfect, wonderful. That is a grand theological position to begin with. And that should be your starting point. But don't try and impose those ideas into antiquity or believe that when you're looking at his translations, that you're recovering the details of actual past historical events.
Yeah, so that's the problem. It's not that he develops it over time. It's that he's trying to claim that all of his new developments are somehow rooted in ancient documents through translation, when in every case, you know, we know that there was no translation going on, that the source documents that he claims to be translating from bear no resemblance, if they exist at all, to what he produced. And it just so happens conveniently that all of his new developments match his evolving theology. And there's almost a pretty clear timeline from start to finish as his theology and doctrine develops. Then he's trying to find these source documents that he can claim are the origins of the changes. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah. In a nutshell, that pretty much captures it. I remember reading, way back when on my mission, some of the writings of Hiram Andrus, and I remember how he tried to explain the notion of the oneness of God in early Mormon scripture. And he talked about this idea of divine investiture of authority. And that's the notion of where God the Father gives to Jesus Christ the authority to speak in the first person as if he were God the Father himself. And even though Hiram Andrus is arguing that they're separate beings, that's why we have these, you know, these instances of where the Son is speaking in the revelations, and then all of a sudden, it's the Father speaking, but no change of characters. There's no change of no cast of characters has changed here. It's the same person speaking, but this is where the difficulty comes in, is why don't we have clear examples of that, like we have in the pre-1835 revelations, after 1835, all of a sudden divine investiture of authority disappears. Jesus is no longer speaking in the first person as the Father. Well, the reason why is because Jesus and the Father are no longer the same divine being. They have separated. You know, ontologically, they are separate beings now. Whereas prior to that, they were a unified being, where that unified being could speak as Father and Son. And so it's that type of thing that I think interpreters of Mormonism are going to have to grapple with and come to terms with. And the thing is that the ancient texts, which are not revealed in sequential order, right? They're all over the map. There are portions that are from antediluvian times. There are portions from, events happening in the Americas. There's the Abrahamic tale. There's a portion of it that was translated in Kirtland, another portion that gets translated in Nauvoo. When you set these things out in terms of which the ancient chronology should be, the theology jumps all over the map on the view of God. It's one God. It's multiple gods. It's all over the map, right? There's no clear development to it, no line upon line, if you will, and the evolution and unfolding of God. But the minute you take all of these ancient texts and lay them out in the order Joseph Smith receives them, then the natural progression and evolution appears. And we can see it going from one God to many, right through all of these ancient texts. And that tells me, again, that what we are looking at are vehicles for disclosing Joseph Smith's theology.
Right. All right, Brent. So we've talked, you know, we've talked about the Book of Abraham. We've talked about the Book of Mormon. You know, we've talked about your early years in the church. Now I'm going to pepper you with all sorts of questions. Some of it's going to have to do with the Book of Abraham. Some of it's going to have to do with other stuff. Real quick, back to the Book of Abraham. Are there any credible non-LDS Egyptian scholars that have in any way validated any of the scholarship coming out of Farms and, you know, the Maxwell Institute, etc.? Or is there evidence to the contrary where Egyptian scholars have said, this is total bunk?
I'm not aware of any Egyptologists, non-LDS at all, who would concur with the bulk of Book of Abraham apologetics. That's not to say that, especially with the text critical studies that Brian Hoglett is doing, that I'm involved in myself, that the Joseph Smith Papers Project will be involved in and are. That's not to say that there aren't non-LDS scholars who would look at that work and say that this is very well done. This is a credible reconstruction of these manuscripts and their stemmas or family trees and so on. But I'm unaware of any Egyptologist who would be supportive of some of the work that we've seen by some of the better-known Book of Abraham apologists, whether it's Hugh Nibley or any of his students who have followed in his wake. I don't know of any.
And you know, have modern Egyptologists, you know, tried to translate the papyri or made comments about the papyri, and just, you know, at a high level, what have they said when they have?
Well, you know, essentially that they translate, and yes, the answer is yes to that, and it's happened over decades now. You know, we're moving up on, it was in 1916, I think, when Reverend Spalding had a group of eminent Egyptologists do their initial translations on the facsimiles and so on, and they all came to the conclusion that Joseph Smith did not know how to translate Egyptian. We moved down through the decades, Klaus Baer, others who just absolutely, you know, we're convinced that Joseph Smith did not know how to translate Egyptian. We move up to contemporary day, where Robert Rittner and others have been involved in translating portions, who, again, are very well credentialed and knowledgeable Egyptologists who have just said this bears no resemblance to anything Joseph Smith said about these documents.
Okay. Okay, what, you know, there are a lot of Mormons, I think, for many years that basically said, well, Hugh Nibley is brilliant, Hugh Nibley's a scholar, he's so smart, I can't understand anything he's writing, and he figured out everything there was to figure out about the Book of Abraham, and he said it's all A-okay.
Yeah, that's the apologetic on the shelf phenomenon, where you don't even have to read the book, right? All you have to do is own it, have it sitting on your shelf that you can point to and say, and reassure yourself that book answers all my questions. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, many of the things that Hugh Nibley said, and I can speak to this specifically, because although I am not an Egyptologist, I am very, very familiar with the Book of Abraham manuscripts to as most an intricate level as anyone I know, quite frankly. And I can say that in numerous instances where Nibley was talking about the things that I do know about, and that is these documents and manuscripts, that he not only got them wrong, but grossly wrong in certain instances, where I had very difficult times trying to reconcile what on earth he was doing or saying about them. And I can only think that he, because I do think that Hugh Nibley was an intelligent, bright man. I can only think that he just simply did not have enough time with it and spend enough time with these manuscripts to make sense of them, because some of the things he says, quite frankly, I find bewildering. I read them. I have the manuscripts right in front of me, high-resolution images of them, and I can't make sense of what he's trying to say at times. And that's quite honestly, that was kind of my, I suppose I did have a crisis of faith, other than a failure of faith that I described previously, but, and that would be with Hugh Nibley. Because I thought that he had so many answers to so many important issues. And what I came to appreciate about Hugh is that I felt that he was quite a brilliant and witty social commentator. And at so many levels, it gave some really remarkable insights about society and culture. But when it came to Mormon history in particular, it seemed like a lot of that broke down, because he had a very specific task at hand, and that was in certain instances to defend the indefensible. And that's what I think he was charged with, and that's what I think he attempted to do. And some of his work, like I said, particularly on the Book of Abraham manuscripts, has just left me shaking my head, wondering, what on earth are you looking at that's led you to this conclusion about this document? And I think a lot of folks have rested on their laurels and not tried to actually investigate these issues themselves, and assumed that if an apologist has produced a book, that everything is okay. And quite honestly, for many faithful, they don't need to take the effort to explore all this. If they find happiness with what they have and enough reassurance with what they have sitting on their bookshelves. But there are others of us, I guess, who are out there who really do wonder about things. We're curious about life, the world, want to know how things work. And for those who are more exploratory in that sense when it comes to belief and scripture and so on, I don't think that the apologetics that have been delivered regarding the Book of Abraham will suffice over time in any way, shape, or form. I think that, in fact, to be honest with you, I see in the LDS Church's statement on the Book of Abraham and historicity already a shifting away from the older apologetics to trying to find new ways of understanding, which I see as, you know, what is the inevitable result of any progressive movement who wants to have longevity and retain, you know, membership and retain an intelligent membership as well. So
right, okay. So not a big respecter of Hugh Nibley's work with relation to trying to explain the Book of Abraham.
That was not his forte.
Okay. So what about you know, you hear the name John Gee, that this guy is a credible Egyptologist, that he studied under the greats. I don't know if it's at UCLA or where, but this guy knows his stuff. What are your high level reactions to his work on the Book of Abraham?
Well, the same thing that I may say about Hugh and others. I mean, in my mind, John Gee may well be the most brilliant Egyptologist who's ever lived, but his work that he's done on the Book of Abraham manuscripts is just horrible. And, you know, this presentation that he had somebody else deliver for him at a fair conference a few years ago, where he's trying to argue that the characters on the Book of Abraham manuscripts were taken from all over the papyri fragment and not sequentially copied. That was probably one of the most ludicrous presentations I've ever seen. You know, I didn't hear it personally, but I saw a write-up of it, and it was ridiculous and completely unfounded. And again, to me, that goes to the heart of a person's credibility. You can publish in every Egyptological peer-reviewed journal in the world, but if you can't produce, you know, analyses of these documents that can withstand critique, then you probably have no business even discussing them. And I've seen this repeatedly with John Gee. And again, to me, when it comes to him explaining these documents, in my opinion, I have yet to see something that I would consider credible coming from him.
Okay. And the church is even walking away, it seems, from his approach, right?
Yeah. Let's put it this way. I would say that they're opening doors to other approaches. So it may not be that they are completely walking away from the apologetic stance that he's taken in the past, but they're gravitating more toward what I would consider to be actually far more credible approaches to the Book of Abraham, and approaches that could ultimately retain faith as well as be being honest with the evidence and being rigorous with the evidence. I'm reluctant to use that word honesty in this case because I think there are scholars who have made a genuine effort to try and defend the Book of Abraham in terms of scholarship, but irrespective of whatever personal motivations folks may have, at minimum, they lack credibility when it comes to actually dealing with the documents.
Right. Any thoughts about, is it Kerry Mulestein?
Right. And again, Kerry seems like a very nice person. And again, along with John Gee, he may be an absolutely brilliant Egyptologist. But when it comes to dealing with the documents, the manuscripts, I just, at this stage, I don't even see him as being on the playing field. He evidently sees himself otherwise and is publishing things fairly far and wide. I guess he's working on a book now, and which I look forward to reading when it comes out, and I'll certainly consider whatever information he has there. But in much of what I've seen from him thus far, you know, again, when it comes to the manuscripts and understanding their relationship to each other, he just makes statements that are just so puzzling and mind-boggling Most recently, he made a comment about how we don't really know who translated the facsimile interpretations, even though he acknowledges that they were printed under Joseph Smith's oversight, and so on, in the Times and Seasons. We still don't know for sure, because they're not in Joseph Smith's handwriting, even though it was his scribe who writes down the interpretations of the facsimiles. We still don't know for sure whether or not Joseph Smith actually produced the interpretations. And I look at that and I think, you know, if that's something we can't know from history and the documents, and know the roles that each individual played, you know, who the scribes were versus who the translator was and so on, then we can't know anything about Joseph Smith. And maybe that would be ideal for some apologists, quite frankly. But in this case, I think to make an assertion like that, that Joseph Smith allowed into his publication that he oversaw, that he allowed somebody else's interpretation of these documents to be published as a translation, right? Nobody ever said that Willard Richards was a translator, seer, and revelator. They did say that Joseph Smith was. Nobody ever said that about Willard Richards. To suggest that somehow other people are coming up with this and Joseph Smith is just simply sliding it into the text is simply nonsensical, and it's a useless apologetic. It's a non-starter, because when people think about it rationally, they're going to reject it out of hand. I mean, it's nonsense.
Talk super briefly just about who Robert Rittner is and what he's done with the Book of Abraham briefly, and what he would say to the arguments of Carey, Mulstein, and John Gee and others.
Well, Robert Rittner is a world-renowned Egyptologist. He works out of the Oriental Institute, the University of Chicago. He has done a full translation of all of the Book of Abraham papyri and fragments, and has actually done a remarkable job of reconstructing some of the smallest fragments that we have that were glued to different pieces of paper that were completely unrelated. And he's reconstructed which pieces they belong to, given full translations of all of them. And I think his message would be decisive to a John Gee or Carey Mulstein, and that is that Joseph Smith did not know how to translate Egyptian, and that the papyri that were in his possession had nothing to do with Abraham.
Yeah, and that's significant, I think. I guess some people want to know if you've got a book coming out, like, you know, some have even asked for some reason if you're kind of moving away from Mormon studies. Just talk super briefly about any research or future plans you have with the Book of Abraham.
I've had intentions to write a book-length treatise on a variety of aspects of the Book of Abraham for some time. And in fact, the book that became the translation effort of Robert Rittner, that was published by Signature Books, was actually begun under my editorship. And so I've had an intention of doing this for some time. And over the last few years, and spending, you know, more and more time with the manuscripts, I decided that the best approach would be to begin by putting out different articles relating to certain facets that are illustrative of various aspects of analyzing the Book of Abraham manuscripts, and to put those out and then eventually compile a book-length work on top of it. So, for example, in the next John Whitmer Historical Association Journal, which will be out next week, it's got one of my articles, one of my Book of Abraham related articles in it.
Got it.
Yeah.
What would you say to somebody, a critic, who says Brett Metcalf has no graduate degree at all, let alone a graduate degree in Egyptology? He doesn't deserve to be even referred to as a scholar. He's not even on the playing field. What would you say to that?
I would say that the proof is in the pudding. And so I don't know of any university that's giving out PhDs in Book of Abraham studies. And yet that's what we're really talking about here. And we're talking about getting down to the nitty-gritty. You can be an Egyptologist at any level. And yes, that's going to certainly give you an advantage in trying to understand the history of the papyri and so on, but it's not going to give you any advantage to interpreting the manuscripts. And the fact is that that requires a very detailed eye, very analytical eye, an understanding of you know, manuscripts creation and so on. And you know, I'm willing to put up my work against anyone's, and that's not to say that there aren't some very talented people, or somehow I am the be-all, end-all, because I hope that there are numerous scholars who will step up to the plate and surpass me in every way. That's kind of the whole idea of this enterprise, is that you want to see people come up with new and exhilarating thoughts and ideas. And but, you know, again, the proof is in the pudding. And if you can come up with a proper scholarly analysis, that's what will stand up to critique. And time will tell. And I'm more than happy to subject to anything that I write on the Book of Abraham or anything related to Mormonism to the most rigorous critique.
And if we're keeping score, the extent to which your scholarship has been validated by objective sort of third-party Egyptologists, you know, my guess is that you would have a lot of support. And conversely, my guess is that any of the work of John Gee and Carrie Mullistein and others, Hugh Nibley, would all be sort of summarily scoffed at by you know, credible Egyptologists. Is that pretty true?
I would say that personally, I'm almost uncomfortable with those types of comparisons, because I feel like that everybody's work should be judged on its own merits. And, you know, it may well be that tomorrow John Gee or Kerry will come up with just a brilliant argument that I hadn't thought of before. And I would think that is just an excellent contribution to our understanding of this. I don't feel like that when, you know, it's easy to throw around the terms apologist and critic without taking into consideration that those labels do not necessarily capture the totality of a person's work. And so what I would say is that on the things that I have done research on, extensive research relating to the manuscripts of the Book of Abraham, I have serious concerns about the quality and credibility of the work that some apologists have put out. And that's what I feel probably most comfortable with saying. As to whether or not, how they would stack rank in a university situation other than BYU. I'll leave that to Egyptologists to voice their opinions on that.
Thanks for joining us today on Mormon Stories. If you enjoyed this episode, please help us make more like it by becoming a monthly subscriber at mormonstories.org. Music for this episode was provided by the Lower Lights.
When other sources cease to make